History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned, of course, that they don't have to go untold. As long as we're willing to take the initiative and ask some questions and then listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Fairfield, California is a city of roughly 120,000 in Solano County. In fact, it's the county seat. It's known as the headquarters of Jelly Belly. You can even take factory tours there. And since Fairfield is also home to Travis Air Force Base, it has a significant veteran population. Quite a few of those veterans live at Paradise Valley Estates, a nonprofit life plan community for the 60 and older crowd, and I had the privilege of speaking there recently. Over the weeks and months ahead, you'll meet some of the special people I got to meet. Among the residents at PVE, as the locals call it, is one of our last living links to the liberation of Dachau concentration camp. You've heard Dan Doherty's name on this program before, thanks to his friend Alex Kershaw, the prolific World War II author. But there's much more to Dan's story than just the horrific scene he witnessed in April of 1945, and we're going to get to hear it from this 98-year-old Army veteran himself, starting with his childhood.
Well, I remember very well. I grew up in Austin, Minnesota, and graduated from high school there in 43, and it was just a wonderful place to grow up as a child. It was rough because of the snow, but, you know, when you're sledding and tobogganing and doing everything else, it's a lot of fun. But then on Sunday, December 7th, we were sitting in our living room and the radio comes on about Pearl Harbor. And the first thing they announced was that Arizona had been hit. Well, my dad's brother, we knew, was on the Arizona. And my dad's face just turned white, and he went down on the Arizona. And so from that just changed everything, because I was then about a freshman in high school. I was 16. So everything was geared toward knowing that I would be going into the Army when I graduated in 43. And some of my buddies qualified for the Navy V-12 program and quit high school right then and there and joined that and went right into junior college. And they got themselves a very good college education during the war. Well, I couldn't qualify because of my eyes. So I took the A-12 test to get into the Army college program. And I passed, and then they told me to join the inactive reserve. So in high school, I was in the inactive reserve and then did nothing. But the day I graduated, on the 6th, a week later, I got noticed for active duty and was inducted in June 23rd, 43. So I would have been drafted, but this way I went right into the Army. And the goal was to see if I could get into the Army College program, and I did 4 months of basic training in the infantry at Fort McClellan, Alabama. And then at the end, they sent three of us who had passed that test off to college, and we were at St. Louis University studying engineering. And this was in the winter of 43-44. And then in March of 44, the Army decided they didn't need any more engineers, and they canceled the entire Army specialized training program for engineers. Mm-hmm. And thousands of us who were all privates were sent to depleted combat units. Our group at St. Louis went to the 44th Division, and we did the next 6 months finishing up in Kansas. The first week in September, we sailed from Boston, and we were the first ship to go direct to France. Everybody else went to the UK and then got ferried over, but we went right to Cherbourg, and we got there the first week of September, so it's 3 months after D-Day.
And I want to ask you about some things along the way, but before I forget, I mean, you mentioned December 7th, 1941, and I've interviewed over 1,000 World War II veterans, and almost everyone has a memory of that day, but very few a memory like yours.
Yeah.
I mean, this is your uncle, and I'm assuming that you had spent some time with him.
I'll tell you, we were from Minnesota. He had joined the Navy in World War I and stayed in and made it a career. And so when you're in Minnesota and he's in the Navy, you don't see him very often. But I only remember him one time, but he stopped through seeing his brothers. It was either about 39 or 40. I think he was maybe changing ships or what the occasion was. But he sat down with me and he told me what he did. He fired the guns on the Arizona. And he showed me how things would go back and forth, and when it was just right, he turned the key. And so I knew him just from that one little interview, but I remember it very well, exactly where we were sitting when he told us about it. So I hardly knew him, but I knew enough so that the moment we heard it, we knew. It's interesting. We've always assumed he went down on the Arizona, but it turns out there's a mass grave of about 100 or so sailors from the Arizona who were buried in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And they're now doing a DNA on all those things. And our son up in Seattle has given his DNA for them. So they're checking to see if by any chance he's one of those. But otherwise, we just assumed that he was on the ship and when it hit, went down. But
and what was his name?
His name was Ralph Doherty.
And have you been there to the Arizona Memorial?
Been there, and his name's up on the wall, Ari Doherty. And one of my dad's brothers was graduated from West Point in 1917 and went right overseas as part of the American Expeditionary Force. And he was killed commanding a battalion of the 3rd Division in the middle of October 15th, 1918, just 3 weeks before the armistice. So when the armistice occurred, his family thought he was alive. And after the armistice, they got the telegram. So it was especially painful. And I knew that. And so toward the end of World War II, I and everybody else was doing everything we could to stay alive because we didn't want to be a victim in the last week or so of the war.
Wow.
Just based on your own family's experience.
Yeah. So if people aren't putting two and two together, so your father lost a brother in World War I and in World War II.
He had another brother that served in World War I. My dad was the oldest boy in the family, was already married and had a child. And in World War I, they never got around to drafting anybody who was married and had a child. And so he was, but he had, my mother had several brothers that were in the World War I too as well. Yeah, they were that age.
So your family had been a Gold Star family for a long time, and you didn't want to have that happen again.
I had to, yeah.
And how many of your siblings were in World War II?
I have a brother and a sister, and my brother was older. He got an appointment to Annapolis and graduated in 45. So he graduated. He was there during the war and graduated in June and then went out on a minesweeper for the few months of the rest of the war. He didn't stay in the Navy, but he got called back for Korea and served again and then turned out. But he ended up living in Charleston, South Carolina.
And, you know, you talked through the process. You go into the ASTP program, you're studying engineering at St. Louis till they say, sorry, we need some bodies over there. And then you're going across the Atlantic. Do you remember what was going through your mind as you left the States behind and headed to this world you didn't know anything about?
Well, I remember on the ship, number one, we were part of a big convoy, but they still had all kinds of tests for in case the submarines and stuff. We had all kinds of practices, I think. But we played cribbage all the way over, some other guys and I. We just hoped we would get there without having any incident along the way. And it took about 8 or 9, 10 days to get there.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
Not at that point, no. No. And then it turns out, to skip ahead, we came back from Le Havre and went to Boston. And then in the summer of 1948, I went to England, and I went on the same ship that I'd come home on.
How about that?
Yeah, as a student, three years later, yeah.
But in between, you saw a few things. And yeah. I'm always, I know it's hard to think back this far, but I'm always curious to understand the mindset, because you're a teenager going off to a war that you know has claimed so many lives, including your uncle's. Did you have any thoughts as to whether you'd be making it back alive?
No, I didn't think about that. You're just living day to day, and you're young, and the whole world's ahead of you. But you know, especially when you're in the infantry, that there's a very, very high casualty rate. So everybody who got into ASTP, the college program, some of those guys had been sergeants in the Air Force and Ordnance and Quartermaster Corps, and they'd taken a cut to private because they wanted to go to college. And then they're in the college program, and boom, it quits, and not a single one of them made it back to where they'd come from or got their rank back. They all went into the infantry as privates, and they were hollering and screaming and wrote their congressman. They did everything. I had just come from the infantry basic training as a private, so I was just going back to it. But a lot of them felt they had a lot to lose, and there was a lot of disappointment at that point for them. In fact, we got home for Christmas one day for 43, and then I got back, and a lot of the guys had made it to their homes, and we were in St. Louis, and they had been from Chicago, and one of them came back with an article from the Chicago Trib predicting an early demise of ASTP. Well, from that point on, we stopped studying.
What's the point?
And 2 months, 3 months later, it folded. Mm. It was good intelligence.
I guess so.
So a teenager from Austin, Minnesota was about to head overseas. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, Dan Doherty's experiences in combat in Europe during World War II and why a sprained ankle might have been a big blessing in disguise. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.